Well, welcome into the show. Of course, later on, we'll be looking ahead to England against Italy in the European Championships final. But we make no apologies by starting today's programme by paying tribute to our good friend, Paul Mariner, who passed away today at the age of 68. What's been striking, what's been emotional, what's been overwhelming over the last 24 hours is that everyone who seems to have met Paul, known Paul, been lucky enough to call Paul a friend, has the same thing to say about him. As great of a contribution he made on the pitch, it was off the pitch where you really met the legend that is Paul Mariner. We'll start with the football bits. We'll start with the fact that he started at Plymouth Argyle. That was his first real professional contract back in 1973. At Ipswich is where he really made his name. So much success at the Tractor Boys. Then he made that big move to Arsenal. And let's not forget his contribution to England. He scored the goal that saw them qualify for the World Cup in 1982. Taking a look at his resume, it's impressive. Of course, for England, he played in the World Cup in 82 and the Euros in 1980, scoring 13 goals in 35 appearances. Ipswich is really where his status is legendary on the pitch. So many Ipswich fans have told me that they had posters of him on their bedroom growing up. A key part of their success winning the FA Cup and the UEFA Cup under Bobby Robson. After he finished playing, obviously, then it was about his managerial career. He was an assistant at New England Revolution, and that's where he settled in Boston and where he started to get us to know us here at ESPN, where he joined the ESPN FC family, where he became, well, our mate.
You off Halloween?
Me?
Yep.
No.
Surprise.
Lights off.
What do you mean? You got all dressed up and you're not going out? Oh.
Most exciting game you're ever involved in?
England, Hungary at Wembley. We won 1-0.
Who scored the goal?
Let me think. Me.
Yeah!
But because of my nimble feet, I just...
that's your hand.
Yeah. It's better to be great at something rather than wear some hideous blazer on the television.
You don't like his jacket, do you?
No, I don't. When you put that T-shirt on, whatever it is, with that jacket...
It's OK.
That's not your game.
Well, just show us how you text again.
that's a big phone.
Paul Mariner's 17th, 49th birthday.
Chocolate mousse.
Chocolate
what?
Come on!
Hey, get your hands up for that!
You know it!
You know it! You love it!
Yeah. Some weather here on the East Coast, hasn't it? But fear not, Paul Mariner is well prepared. Look at these!
What's wrong with
Look at that!
You're ready for the snow and the rain.
I'm ready for it all.
Well,
and the beach.
Yes, but you can...
Go, put your trumpet back in your case.
Show everyone what your trumpet looked like again. Right. That's a trombone.
Well, a trombone, whatever.
That is a brilliant picture. That is geography teacher
who is
about
that?
To retire.
Is it which
no,
finger?
No, why have you got three Maras? But now Dele Alli's come up with a 2.0 version.
Stop it.
That's kind of it, don't?
Yeah, but you're very ambidextrous, aren't you?
I don't know if Maras quite knows what ambidextrous.
Sweden will win it 1-0.
Ooh. Wow, he's very confident, isn't he?
What? Hey, he's wrong, but he's confident. He said, I've had to go and buy a new mower, which kills him, right? I said, what's the matter then? He said, well, right. I can't get it to go in the bag. I said, well, get the rule book. I mean, go on the internet, put, you know.
Instructions.
The instructions.
So it wouldn't be a rule book.
Get the rule book. You know, what's the rules, right?
Best striker in the world, Paul, you're a striker.
Harry Kane.
Really?
Oh, my goodness. All right, Fred Flintstone. Look, whatever name I come up with, you give me a custard pie right in the mush. What a sick moment for Rooney.
Sick?
Oh, sick?
Yeah.
Because I thought with the young boy.
I thought it was fantastic.
That's great young rhetoric for you, isn't it, Paul?
You bloody hypocrite. You sat there 5 minutes ago when we were off here. You went, yeah, he's just doing his job, isn't he?
Well, he is doing his job.
Now you've got it as the greatest goal this century.
If he does that with that group, then he needs knighting. The Queen needs to knight that guy because...
I'm not sure if the Queen can knight someone in Argentina.
You see my form about the number of... What are those things called?
Apps.
Those apps, right? All those things are on it. I've got enough of those things on it.
Right.
I don't want any more on it.
OK. And then what sort of a viewer are you?
Yeah, I get all tingly and nervous and sweaty.
Oh, wow. So you got the tingles. When do they start? National anthem?
Feet. Oh, yeah.
What do we think of Paul's tie today?
What's going on with it? Just because you're brave today with your pink shirt on.
What's the inside? Normally the inside. Oh, look at that.
It's my sharks.
Is that piranhas?
Whatever. You're the expert on fishing.
Ladies and gentlemen, 1 week to go until the World Cup starts. What?
I'm ready.
You're not playing.
Which stadium's atmosphere annoyed you the most?
When Stephen and I were...
I was just thinking about, are you going to say Chicago?
Yes.
I was just waiting to see
you. Never like going to Chicago?
With Clements and Peter Shilton.
Where are you looking? Where are you looking?
I'm looking into the sky because I'm just waxing.
Look at the number one. Go to Paul's camera and the number one.
I didn't even know that was my camera. My name's not Dan Thomas.
Listen, he didn't even know it was a camera.
No, I did.
Take your glasses off. look at the camera.
Put my light on. How's it going, everybody? You got your filthy mitts all over me glasses now.
Which camera should we say goodbye to Gab on? Oh, there it is, the red one.
Where is he?
I love that we can show that and we can laugh along with it. And what I love to be able to show as well is him and Stevie together, because that was such a sight. We all have our cubicles here, all of us. But for whatever reason, when Stevie and Paul were on the same show together, instead of sitting in separate cubicles, they would sit next to each other as if they were coaching still, side by side.
Like kids.
Stevie's there with like his napkin, he's eating whatever sandwich. Paul's next to him and they're watching just the eclectic mix of who knows what on YouTube. Paul is the loudest man you've ever met in your life. Who knows what anyone else was thinking. But I'm sure like you, Stevie was the first person I thought of today.
Yeah, and we know because of those experiences, we know how strong that bond is. And you're thinking about Paul, you're thinking about Stevie, you're thinking about the relationship, you're thinking about us and the interactions that we've had. One of the first thoughts that I had was, in fact, them two sitting in the cubicles together, because even though they're sitting together, we know from around the corner that they were there because of the incredibly loud laughter that Paul had. And when you turn that corner and you see Paul and he sees you and we're about to go to studio and he makes you feel like you're the most important person in the world at that very moment. And I can hear him now saying, there he is. And he comes, shakes your hand, gives you a hug. And now we're talking and we're having a conversation. And for those 30 seconds, for a minute that we're talking, he made you feel like you were his world.
Yeah.
And you can't teach that. You can't fake that. You either have that or you don't. And Paul was so very generous with his love for other people and the relationships that we had here. It is really difficult to talk about Paul without breaking down. And I just have to say, I love that man.
Yeah. And just to epitomize, and there's just so many stories of his generosity. And one time he's over at my house, and my wife mentions that she loves the AC/DC, and it's incredible. Because he says, you know what? Next time they're in town, I'll take you backstage. You can meet them. We hear so many people say that, empty gestures. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just kind of pass by. Next time they're in town, he took her. He didn't have to do that. And look, that just, honestly, that is more memorable than our wedding day for her, meeting AC/DC. That's the sort of guy. The sort of guy that he was.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough. As you see, when I heard the news this morning, I sent Stevie a text straight away. And then I was doing all right during the course of the day, and coming into the gates here, it kind of hit me. And then, as seeing those videos did, there's something about working in this place, and you get to interact with people in a space that have seen it all and done it all in this game. We have Frank here, who's won the World Cup. You talk about Steve, his accolades. You see Paul's. And yet, Paul somehow always seemed to be the best of us. His achievements in the game did not weigh on him. He was happiest to see you. He would laugh at himself. He would tell stories. He really was the best of who this game asked us to be. And in a time over the last 18 months where, you know, we've spoken about life and death and passing, and it's been all around us in so many ways. And you know, death comes to us all. It's the circle of life, as they say. And then you remember Paul. You see Paul. You see the life that he brought to every single place that he was. And it's a hard circle to close. Thinking of Paul, how he was, and what he meant to every single person from the time you met him for 30 seconds. It's really difficult to make this seem real, to make this seem a part of life. We have to accept it. We'll all have to move on. But let's not forget the friendship and the example that Paul Mariner brought to. Let's not forget the humanity that he brought to accomplishment and meeting people and how you impact their lives.
And to that point, Shaq, I would just say, people see what we put on screen and the segments that we put in our shows. And so you feel like you know Paul by watching him on the screen. The truth is some of the best work by Paul happened off screen, in between segments, in the conversations that we were having. You see that video and you get attached to him. But then the times that we had in between takes and the many stories that would come up that would make this superstar a human to us, just like Stevie, a superstar, a human to us. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so incredibly difficult for us, because those interactions were real.
Yeah.
It's not just what you see on the screen.
Yeah.
It's the moments that we live together. And those things you just can't put a price on.
You know, of all the pundits, I think I'm the one I've known Paul the least. But I remember the first time I was in Paris in my studio, and we normally on off say, "Hey, Frank, how you doing?" Yeah. And the first time you told me, "Today we have on the show Paul Mariner." I say, "What?" We have Paul Mariner. I still have goosebumps because that guy represented so much. And it's why maybe it's even harder to accept that, because he was our idol.
Yeah.
He comes from another football, another era. Maybe the youngest cannot understand that, but those players playing for Ipswich Town, nobody knows Ipswich Town now anymore. But when I had the chance to play in FA Cup with Chelsea, I went to Ipswich Town. And the only person I was thinking of was Paul Mariner about that. And when you say Paul Mariner is with us, he talked to me like he had known me forever.
It would have been, I imagine, all right, Frank K.
Frank G.
You didn't need the mic, you can hear him.
Yeah, have you been? I said, what, is Paul Mariner talking to me? And I came over, and I'm not enough time, I guess, sharing time with the guys, and he's been like fantastic fortnight for me to come over. Yeah. Like he's been 3 years ago when I came over and I met Paul. I understand what you feel, guys, and I'm very sorry for you. And it was a shock also for me, but for other reasons, because I wasn't that close to him. But him, Stevie, represents something when we were young that we couldn't even touch.
I want to welcome in Mark Donaldson, who has been writing Paul Mariner's biography. Mark, I suppose you knew already, considering all those people you've been reaching out to compile this book, what a loved man Paul Mariner was.
Yeah, since we put the front cover on social media, there are a number of people that have said, wait a minute, forward by Ian Gillan of Deep Purple. And that was one of his best pals. And I got the message last night, Dan, when I was writing chapter 12 of the book. And I was actually laughing because chapter 12 is music. It's his relationship with Ian Gillan. Deep Purple, one of the biggest bands of the 70s, disbanded and got back together at Nebworth in 1985, their first gig back. So Mariner was invited by Ian Gillan to drink whiskey in the motorhome beforehand with Terry Butcher and Russell Osmond. So then they went to the stage and they sat down beside the stage, and there was no one sitting in this place that they sat in. So they three decided they would sit there as well. They were sitting on £10,000 worth of fireworks, which, if they had exploded, would have taken out 75,000 people. That was Paul Mariner.
And Paul, and I know you've reached out to a lot of former teammates and people that knew him well, Mark, and I imagine what you're hearing the boys describe in the studio is stories that you've heard from everyone around the world.
Yeah, you know what the funny thing is, Dan? Most of the stories that I've had, and I've spoken to like over 40 different people, and I've still got more people to speak to. Football is at the end of all the stories. There's always one. Oh, by the way, we haven't really spoken much about football. Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. But the boys, I mean, I was getting teary. I've been like that. You've been like that all day. It's kind of hit us harder today, even though we knew what was coming. And his partner Val, who obviously I'm liaising with regards to the book and getting contact numbers and various other things, she sent me a photo on midweek, I think it was Wednesday, when Paul was in his hospice bed watching the England game, and they'd put one of his England shirts on him. And there was a photo of him with Val, with George, his son, and with his mum, Peggy, who's in her early 90s. And Paul's got a smile on his face. That was the last photo they took of Paul Mariner, and he's got a smile on his face, and it meant the world to me, to everyone else. And I just hope that when this book comes out in a couple of months' time, that it can do him justice, because what a story this guy has got to tell. I've just got to tell it well for him, and I might put a wee bit of football in there as well.
Thank you very much, Mark. I want to bring in Alexis Nunez to the show as well, who was so close with Paul. Alexis, basically, when you moved to Connecticut, you developed this incredible relationship with him.
Yeah, Dan, you know, I did. And I mean, Shaka called me earlier when, of course, the news broke. And I mean, he didn't even have to say anything, and I just immediately broke down, because I think to know Paul Mariner was truly to love him. And, you know, everyone used to say that you're so lucky you have a coworker that's like a father figure to you. And I used to tell people he's honestly my 68-year-old best friend. He was truly such an amazing person to meet. You know, I'm very thankful that I got to see him last week, and we were still, you know, cracking banter as much as he could, talking about how frustrated he still will forever be with Arsenal, how proud of this England setup he really is, and that he still tunes into the show ESPN FC no matter what. You know, he absolutely loved us all there, and I know that we loved him so much. And one of the things that I've really been taken aback with is the fact that people on social media have reached out, I know, to each one of us, and especially me, and said that they've all commented on Mariner's chemistry with each and every one of us, not just me. Of course, I was constantly posting him, but I think that that's something that, you know, Ale was talking about, and that's something you can't fake, something you can't buy. And there was definitely a special reason why it seemed like Mara's got on with pretty much anybody that walked into that ESPN FC studio. And one thing that I will always remember for him is that in this job, you know, we talk about football so much, and we're taught to be really objective journalists and whatnot. And sometimes after years and years of doing that, it can nullify or neutralize your passion and your love for the game. You just watch it as just another game. And Mara's never did that with the sport. He always showed his passion for any team he used to play for, whether it was Ipswich, whether it was Arsenal, whether it was England. You know, he always had such passion. And I think that that's something that I will forever remember. It reminds us of how lucky we are to be doing what we're doing. It reminds us why football really is the beautiful game. And it reminds us that, you know, it brought us all close to Paul Mariner. And I think that from this day forward, I hope we continue to do this show as passionately as we know Maris would have wanted us to.
Beautifully said, Alexis. Thank you very much. As Alexis says, a major outpouring on social media from a lot of our friends here, Craig. We knew it was coming, but yesterday when we lost our friend and colleague, Paul Mariner, it was emotional to hear. The big man was such a gentleman. He lived life to the full and had done it all. Player, coach, GM, technical director, pundit, we're all going to miss you, big man. Meanwhile, Jan Agerfjordtoff, keeping it simple. RIP Paul Mariner was one of the strikers when I grew up. Jürgen Klinsmann, Rest in peace, dear Paul. All our love and prayers go to the Mariner family. We lost a very, very special person in Paul. A dear friend, a fantastic footballer, a great manager, a fantastic pundit on TV, but most importantly, an amazing person and human being. Gab had the privilege of working with and spending time with Paul Mariner, a class act and a gentleman, and so much more than first met the eye. RIP, Paul. You leave a lot of light behind. It will continue to shine. Henry Winter, chief writer in England. Heartbreaking news. RIP Paul Mariner, 68 FA Cup, UEFA Cup winner. 35 England caps, 13 goals. Wonderful target man, fine coach, and just one of the loveliest people you could meet. Privileged to have watched you and known you. Thoughts with Paul's family and friends. Peter Shilton, I'm so sorry to hear about the loss of Paul Mariner. I had the pleasure of playing with him in the England 82 World Cup in Spain. A great gentleman and terrific player. My condolences to his family at this sad time. This is hard. Steve Nicol. In Paul, we have lost a great player, a great coach, and most importantly, from a selfish point of view, a great friend and someone who had the most incredible... incredible laughs with from the first second we met. I love that man. For more, let's hear from Ian and Taylor.
Well, this is such sad news about Paul. He'll be very sadly missed. I remember him as a very stylish striker. First of all, for Plymouth Argyle, then Ipswich Town under Bobby Robson and England. He played a European Championship at a World Cup as well. Great player, but an even greater guy, wasn't he?
Fantastic. My life changed forever when Steve Nicol hired Paul Mariner to come work with the Revs. I'm a better person because of him. He helped me enjoy the process more, Ian. I'm not even talking about soccer. I'm talking about life. But what I'm going to remember is the laugh, because you could be sitting anywhere in the world. If you heard that laugh, everyone in the building would look around and in the place and in the bar would look around and say, you know what, I'm kind of jealous. I kind of want to be at that table because that guy seems to be having fun. But in all seriousness, from my point of view, I know Paul was in some real pain. So I'm happy he's out of that pain. And my thoughts go to his kids, to Val, and all of us are better people because we knew Paul.
I remember a couple of summers ago, I was with him in Chicago. We were covering one of those summer games. Manchester City were on tour. I always remember that black stripy jacket he used to like to wear all the time.
He loved his stripes, Paul. He did, didn't he?
Yeah. I think he wore blue, of course, for Ipswich Town, where he really made his name. Rest in peace, Paul.
Just the last tribute. This is from his son, George. I'm heartbroken. I lost my dad yesterday after a brief battle with brain cancer. You were an incredible man, so selfless and so loving. You were the life and soul of the party. Whoever met you instantly adored you and fell in love with your charismatic personality. You represented a group of fantastic football clubs as well as the England national team. We couldn't be prouder of you as a family. Your legacy will live on forever. You will always be my hero and a hero to others who admired you throughout your career. I hope we can bring it home for you on Sunday. I know you'll be there willing the boys on. You are an incredible dad. I will forever cherish my memories with you. Love you forever. Paul Mariner, who died at the age of 68. What a man. Soccer, I suppose. It is England against Italy on Sunday in the final of the European Championship at Wembley. For England, their first final since 1966. Let's get some analysis on it, shall we? Alessandro Del Piero and Steve McManaman have been with us throughout the tournament.
The fact that it's you know, England go into it having the first final in 50 years, you know, so that suddenly is a lot of pressure automatically. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of young players in the England side, so you wonder how they're going to cope with it all. The furore, you can imagine what's going on in England at the moment with the outside media, all the people getting behind the team. That brings in itself a whole lot of pressure as well. So, yes, you have to deal with it, you can, but everybody's different. Everybody will struggle. People will be confident. People will take it on the shoulders and drive forward. So there's a whole lot of other things that go on around this game rather than just playing it, actually.
I believe the pressure of the game is on the England shoulder because they play home. They didn't win for a long, long time. Unless we won, you know, some couple of World Cup meanwhile, but it's still a long time also for us to win the Euros, and we lost 8 years ago. But, you know, play home in this situation, I believe they have more pressure, and that's why I also believe they have a little bit of an advantage on the court. England is more powerful physically, and that could be, you know, an issue for Italy in the long term, especially in the second part of the game and eventually extra time. And holding the ball, you know, give also the opportunity to our players that they are really good with the feet and with the skills to break the line that they put together. But to be a very balanced team, I don't know if it's going to be a great game because also Italy have a pressure, okay? You know, we lost 8 years ago and, okay, no one expected that we go to the final, maybe, you know. Semi-final was a great achievement already, but come on, you're there now. Now you're going to finish the work. You want to win. I'm not going to show up just, you know, okay, we were a good sparring partner. No. So that's the point, that the pressure of the game becomes strong. And there's too much to lose for both teams. So that's why it would be probably a game where, you know, let me wait a bit and see what's going to happen.
Who you got in this one?
Well, let me think. I don't know. Italy, for sure, but this is the heart that is speaking. The heart is speaking for Italy 100%, 110%. On the field, it's from my point of view, it will be really, really, really 50-50. Mm. Either that maybe England has a little bit of advantage because of the home field, but because of the pressure is a little bit down from my point of view, so it's 50-50. But my heart, I mean, I can't talk as a... I'm talking as a fan now.
Who you got?
Listen, I hope England win, of course I do. It's going to be very difficult because I think Italy have been the best team in the tournament, but of course I hope England get through in the end.
You want to give me a score?
No. Voila.
50-50, says Alessandro Del Piero. The bookies almost agree with him. And they've got England's slight favourites, you would suggest, because of that home advantage. The game, of course, at Wembley. Let's head there now and hear from Kelly Cates and Stuart Robson.
Thanks, Dan. Well, it's all very quiet around Wembley today, all very sedate, all very serene. Obviously, it's going to be completely different when we head into the final tomorrow between England and Italy. And England, unarguably, have had home advantage. Five of their six games will have been played here at Wembley. In terms of their performances, though, on the pitch, what have you made of them?
Solid, effective, lacking creativity, particularly with their passing. The passing's been too slow at times. It's been too square. There's not been enough forward movement. The key areas in terms of their attacking quality has been the wide players. When Saka's played, when the ball comes into his feet, he gets turned and runs with the ball and he changes defence into attack. And I think you can say the same about Sterling. When he's been running with the ball at defenders, that's when England looked threatening. He's also been in the right places to score goals. But also England have looked more athletic than the teams they've been playing against. And that will be the case against Italy as well.
It's interesting, because as you say, there was lots of criticism of the way that England set up at the beginning of this tournament. Has Gareth Southgate's decision to play in this way been justified by reaching the final?
Yes, to a certain degree, but I don't think he actually had the philosophy, we're going to be solid and we're going to have two holding midfield players. I just don't think they've played very well or passed it forward very well. There hasn't been enough movement between the front players. In the early games, they couldn't find the passes to get it into Harry Kane. They've got better against Ukraine. I thought they were better in the second half against Denmark. They were outplayed in that first half for a certain degree. But England have to play at a high tempo. I think they have to press the ball high against Italy because, as Spain showed, Italy, if they can't play out from the back, they can't go from back to front because Immobile, although he's good running down the side of defenders, he's not very good with his back to goal.
Italy are based, though, on that really solid defence. They barely conceded a goal. So What do England have to do to break that down, or can Italy stay resolute?
We've talked about Sterling. Di Lorenzo is an OK 1v1 defender, but he hasn't got great posts. Daku beat him against Belgium and won the penalty. I think Sterling can get at him. If Emerson plays as the left-back, which we think he will do, he'll try and get forward like Spinazzola did. But again, he's not played that much football, and I don't think he's great defensively. So the two wide players for England could have a field day.
And obviously Spinazzola missing for Italy. He's travelling with them to sort of give them moral support ahead of this game. But is it fair to say that Italy are a team that are more about the team than about star players?
Yeah. If you look at some of their players, I wouldn't say they're the world's best players. There's much better squads in this tournament than Italy. But Mancini has done a magnificent job. They're playing with confidence. They've had a great run. They know exactly what's expected of them. They've played the same system for 3 years. Even when the personnel change, the system stays the same. Insigne will come in off that left-hand side. Emerson will try and make forward runs. They'll switch the play out to Chiesa when they can. The three midfield players will try and control the game. Italy are a good team, but they're not a great team.
Not a great team, but can England get the better of them? We'll find out tomorrow, where it's all going to look a bit different around here, Dan.
Thank you very much, guys. If England are to get the better of Italy, of course, they'll be the first team to do that as they come into the match with this 33-match unbeaten run. I think we're OK. No more crying now, boys.
I've got myself together.
We're all right. We can focus on this game. Frank, just from someone who's played in a World Cup final, how have the players been over the last couple of days? How are you feeling?
Well, they're into the competition, so and as football players, we all know that a game is a game, and even for the fans, it's more important. You just think about, recovering from the semi-final,
right,
and then preparing for the final, but don't put the pressure. And if you have the enough experience, you know that if you play the game before, you're going to struggle during the game. So I think everybody is trying to chill out, to have fun, right, to relax, to be focused when they have to work on the during the training sessions. But otherwise, it's just easy going. Don't read too much newspapers. Don't listen too much to television. Especially, because
you were in France, and obviously this is in England.
Yeah.
But how easy is that to do, to just kind of shut yourself off?
I don't know where they decided to settle down.
So they're in St. George's Park.
Yeah, so you have to be far away from the capital, from the stadium, from the craziness and the medias and everything. And again, you just think about the game, but not in a way that you play it, just in a way that you prepare it. That's it. And after, we all know, it can go either way. I'm very neutral on that matter, and I can say that in England, okay, they play at home, but you play against an unbeaten team for a while. So it can go either way. They know that. Nobody, even with the biggest experience that you have, you don't know how your game is going to go for individually and collectively. You pray for the best, you prepare at the most, but at the end of the day, you don't know how you're going to play because you're just human.
If I was to try and introduce someone to this sport, Ali, I don't feel this would be a match that I would want to show them, to drag them into the joy of football, because I just get this feeling this match is just going to be so tight, so nervy, so edgy. From a neutral's point of view, I don't think it's going to be particularly entertaining.
You're thinking this is going to be a fascinating tactical battle?
I think it's just going to be 120 minutes of through the fingers.
Yes. Well, and part of that has to do with sort of this nervous energy about England and Wembley. And it's coming home.
Yeah.
And all these stories that even if you try to be insulated from it, as Frank is alluding to, you're still hearing it.
Sure.
You still feel the energy of the people, and you feel the energy of the people in the stadium. So say, for example, the game's not going so well for England. There have been some frustrating moments. And then the people start getting antsy, and then the people start getting nervous. The players feel it. You feel that energy as well. You feed off of it when they're supporting you, but you feed off of it as well when, they know it's not going well. We know it's not going well. And now it becomes difficult to execute the game plan that you prepare, and yet you forget about it and say, oh my goodness, what's happening? The moment becomes all too big. So England have to be careful with that. And that's why when you say it's going to be tense, it's tense just because it's a final. It's naturally tense, but it's also tense because You figure that England is going to have difficulty settling into the match. That England is going to have some problems in terms of the experience of being there. And yet Italy haven't had many of these players be on that moment either.
Right.
Yes, Chiellini, you think about Chiellini. Oh, yeah, Chiellini. But what about Immobile? What about Insigne? What about these guys? These guys have the failures of not making a World Cup in their background, in their resumes as well. So do you draw from those experiences,
right,
or do you draw from the success that you've had in this tournament? And that's where the human nature comes in that you have players that have a reason to be nervous and players that have a reason to be successful. Which way you take it, that may just determine what team becomes the champion.
Which way will they take it, Shaq?
What's that?
Which way will they take it? Which squad do you think is the most confident going into this?
I think the more confident squad would be the Italian squad.
Right.
Given how they've performed over recent months and coming into this tournament, given the fact that they don't have to deal with a home crowd. And as Ali points out, home crowds can be an incredible pro. They can also be an incredible con. At the same time, England football fans, as you know well, they are one of two extremes. They're never in the middle. They're either going over the top, as I'm sure they have been all week long, or to Ali's point, if things seem a little bit uncertain during the game, they will go completely the other way, which will absolutely be telling. In terms of a tactical battle, which I think invariably it will be, all finals are, the Italians traditionally, culturally, are more comfortable just controlling games and being patient about things, whereas English football is far higher tempo. Mm. And that's the excitement that fans look for, that players are used to. That is a lot of the time the hinge in which finals are decided. So coming into this one, given all those cons that you can put at England's doorstep, I just feel that the Italian squad maybe come into this in a slightly better mindset.
Dan, I think really knowing football nowadays and what we see throughout all competition, but especially this year, I feel that the one who's going to lose will go through a tragedy for his country. You know, the team is going to lose. And that's horrible for me because I feel, you know, that Italy really need that because they're going through a new cycle and it will be a big stop if they don't win. And England, with the pressure of the media, the pressures of the fans, you know, that finally you reach a final.
I don't know, Frank. Yeah, is there a feeling that we've made the final?
No, I swear to God, you're lying to yourself saying that. You really know that if England loses, nobody's going to be partying in London or everywhere in England. Nobody's going to go back crying home.
No, you're still partying. You're still celebrating.
I tell you.
What you don't want it to be is a bad refereeing decision or a stupid mistake from a player.
Sincerely, I think English fans and English players want the win. They don't want the runner-up medal. And in Italy, it's the same. I tell you, it's going to be tragedy. And nobody's going to party if they lose. So it's going to be... Let's get some dramatic
prediction then, Frank.
1-1.
They both can't lose. So that's
because I'm very neutral, I say 1-1.
Right.
And I think England in penalties.
Ooh.
Oh my God. Tense.
Yeah, but you know, tactically, a very interesting game.
Oh. Fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating.
I don't know that I was ready to give a prediction just yet.
Who would have thought I would be at Vars?
I know. It's a trick question.
Really come out of the blue.
Trick question. No, I... You know what? I want to see you smile. I'm going to go with England.
Oh, you don't have to do it for me.
No, I'll do it for you.
That's all right.
I'll do it for you. Dan, I'll do it for you.
Yeah, but
you keep this show together.
Oh, gosh. There's a very professional prediction.
Why?
Just for you to see you smiling. I'm not going to say England. Well, okay. Thank you.
I knew the question was coming down, right? And I'm in full agreement with Frank. I think we 1-1 and England on penalties.
Oh,
well,
wait a minute.
No,
did we all say that England is going to win? No chance. Wow. Can I change it? I'm going to go Italy. That's it.
For Dan.
He's going to party regardless. He said he's going to be happy. They've made the final.
Definitely partying regardless.
That's it. Italy's going to win.
Join us then. 6 p.m. tomorrow for reaction to the final. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at electricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's electricebikes.com. Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
If you want even more analysis looking ahead to the final, be sure to check out the latest edition of the Gab and Jules podcast. Right then, so the action as Frank leaves us. Mark Clattenburg joins us, who's refereed what? Olympic final?
Mm-hmm.
European Championship final? Champions League final?
Mm-hmm.
World Cup final?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Not bad.
and I've got the tattoos.
Mr. Modest, eh? Crikey O'Reilly. How was it for a referee before a final? Are you nervous as the players?
Yeah, but tournaments are different. One-off games like Champions League, it's you're in day before, you do the game and then you leave. Tournaments, in the end, everybody wants to leave. You've been there for a month.
Right.
So in the end, you want
to... Just get it over with.
Yeah.
Don't make any mistakes.
Sure.
Let's talk about, shall we, the big refereeing decision that led up to this final, shall we? Raheem Sterling going down in extra time. I know this is something you've discussed before, but I'm just intrigued to get the psyche of a referee as to why you feel the need to make this decision.
He's in a really good position here, and what he probably thinks is that the first defender that comes across, that leg there, because he steps forward, he thinks that that's made enough contact
right.
for Raheem Sterling to go down.
And once he gives the penalty and there is contact, there's nothing that VAR can do about it.
No, because what the VAR will do, the referee will be speaking to the VAR, tell him what he's actually seen, seeing the trip, and therefore the VAR would have concentrated on that trip and seen that there's contact. Enough contact, that's debatable.
Right.
But there's contact, and there has to be absolutely no contact for the VAR to overturn that.
If that's at the other end and it's Denmark, he's not given that in a million years, is he?
Well, you can never say that.
Yes, you can. You can definitely say that.
I think one of the most important things is
It's such a crucial time of the game. And to give such a crucial decision that influences the game is one of the ones that everybody's debating around the world, because most people are saying it's not a penalty. Some people say it is. I think Shaka said it is. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a problem with that.
Right.
But as a referee, you've got to be 100% sure. And I would rather in that situation, and that's such a crucial moment, to say no penalty.
Yeah.
But then the VAR to say go to the screen, there is enough contact to go penalty. But to influence the result like this, this is what's upset a lot of people around.
Is that a rush of adrenaline? The moment just getting a bit carried away?
I think it could be a multitude of things. If you remember early in the game with a penalty situation with Harry Kane.
Yeah.
That was possibly more of a penalty, even though I don't agree it's a penalty. That was more of a penalty than Raheem Sterling. And you don't prejudge players. You never prejudge players. But one thing you do...
You must prejudge players.
Never prejudge. You do a lot of homework. You do a lot of research. Then there's an analyst.
That sounds like revision to prejudgment.
They've got an analyst, an ex-player, an Italian guy who was working in the last Euro when I was there. And one day before the match, they would sit down with you and talk about tactics. Mm. And what's more important now for the modern day referee is it's not just about the laws of the game. You've actually now, the best referees in the world are the ones that see it before. They see the decisions before. So when Raheem Sterling's going inside the penalty area, you're now switching on to get the best position to make sure that if there's contact, the contact's enough to award a penalty.
Is there like a FIFA rankings of players, like in the video game, where you've got like speed, stamina, and diving is the one in particular that you concentrate on?
Was it like them top trumps cards used to have?
Ali would be
skill 9, diving 9.
Ali would definitely be a 9. Definitely be a 9 or a 10. Just one more thing about that incident that people have brought up is the fact that randomly there were two balls on the pitch.
Yeah. A few years ago, that would have been disallowed.
Right.
When there's two balls on the pitch, the game should have been stopped. However, they changed this law, I think it was about two seasons ago, because what could happen, and it used to happen, was the technical area, ball, there was a promising attack, they throw the ball onto the pitch, so therefore the game had to stop. Did this ball that was on the pitch influence this play? No. Therefore, within the new laws, because that ball didn't interfere with that attack and move, therefore that ball is irrelevant.
Imagine if you were the person who put that ball on the pitch and it has to get disallowed. Good luck with that.
Good luck.
Wow, you'd be in big trouble. We all agree then, clever play from England. Nothing compared to the dark arts of the Italians, though. And there's something I wanted to bring up, just comparing the time in play against Austria compared to that of Belgium. Of course, towards the end of that Belgian tie, Italy clearly wasting time. And you take a look here, 5 minutes difference between the ball in play during the Austria tie and the Belgium match. How much is that a referee's responsibility to keep on top of?
It is, but what you've also got to look at the statistic of total fouls. So there's 7 more fouls, so 7 more fouls will create breaks in play, of course.
Right.
But what the Italians are very, very good at, and they've been like this for many, many years. It's not time. I don't call it time wasting. I will call it absorbing time. They're very clever at absorbing time. Because time wasting is obvious. You can see it's obvious.
Right.
For example, do you really, as a referee, and this is interesting because there's no sole timekeeper, only the referee, does he stop his watch every time? No.
Right.
Normally when there's an injury, you put 30 seconds onto the added on time. But sometimes, for example, the Italians, they'll go down injured or cramp. And it's not just the time wasting it's causing, it's also breaking up play. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's not just, let's add another minute on, it's breaking the flow of the game. And that's what probably the Italians do best. How do you stop it? It's very difficult because as a referee, if a player goes down injured, I'm not a doctor.
Right.
I'm not a doctor.
But you can just add on the appropriate amount of time, though.
You could do.
Well, that's what you should do, isn't it?
But you're right. But what we used to be told was 30 seconds for this, 30 seconds for this, 30 seconds for this, 30 seconds for every substitution. If you really time the substitution, what are you going to do? Unless you have a sole timekeeper outside of the referee's jurisdiction to combat this, the referee's then going to be doing this.
Well, why don't they have a sole timekeeper then?
That's one thing that the pub.
Would you like that?
At the top level? Certainly, unless I've got a flight home where I want to get off.
Mark, you just mentioned that you do your homework and preparation for each team and each player. Now, you just told us that this is what the Italians do best. if you're going to go and referee a game where Italy is going to play, wouldn't you have this as part of that preparation? Wouldn't you have this as part of the background coming into the match?
Certainly it'd be in the back of your mind, because it's all score driven.
Right.
If Italy are losing, they're not going to waste time.
Right.
Are England going to waste time? Whoever's in front in this European final will absorb time.
Sure.
They'll delay the goal kicks. The goalkeepers will take a yellow card late in the match because it means nothing. They will do everything in their power to win football. And this is what referees need to understand. It's about winning football matches. And they'll do whatever they can in whatever way they can. But referees can use certain techniques. For example, I used to use it when a player was injured. I used to just go straight to the stretcher. Not the doctor, stretcher. Right. Let's get the stretcher on. Let's get him on the stretcher.
Off you go. Yeah.
Is there an argument to be made, which we've discussed in the studio, about having NBA-style clocks, where once the ball goes out of play, the clock stops, and then you play 60 minutes or whatever it is, as opposed to 90 minutes at the referee's discretion as to what those stoppages look like? As a referee, what's your opinion on that?
I would be all for it if it improves the actual product itself. What's interesting from them statistics, 63 minutes is unbelievable. Mm. When I first refereed in Champions League around 2006, the average was 42, 43 minutes.
Wow. Mm.
So the game has improved and we are seeing a lot more play, but we are seeing some ways of slowing games up. When the right moments, when Italy are winning.
When you were at IFAB, was there ever a discussion about having an independent timekeeper?
Not of any formal kind of discussion, but I am one who felt that keep it as it is. It wasn't broken, let's not try to fix it. I thought it's something that referees and the game can manage, but at the highest level of those decisions, it was never a formal topic of discussion.
One last word on Italy regarding the dark arts, however you want to say it. Ciro Immobile, of course, went viral after he goes down. The goal is scored, obviously, and then everything continues. So you, as a referee, how do you deal with that situation?
You'd just laugh at him.
Would you physically laugh?
Oh, I would just say, please, you're embarrassing yourself.
Right.
Because what he did was embarrassing.
Okay.
When the goal was scored and he gets up and starts running around again, that's the moment when you go past and say, please, you're embarrassing in yourself. You've actually highlighted it to me, which then puts doubt in your mind again that these type of players are willing to do that to try and influence a decision. And that's something that you've then got to put into his head. So it's a bit of reverse psychology that I know what you're going to do, so hopefully it will stop him in the future in the matches.
Which takes us...
Does that influence your decision then? Later on in the match, there's a foul. All of a sudden, he's going down in the box because a trailing defender from Denmark takes him down, quote-unquote.
Yeah, but if you've got a doubt, VAR's there.
Right.
VAR's there to help you. So if I've got a doubt for this, because Immobile isn't always correct in his way of playing... As a referee, you've got to have in your mindset to think, you know what, I need to have a doubt. And if I've got a doubt, I would rather say no foul, no penalty, for the VAR to say, go and check it.
Now, is the doubt a little bit greater with Immobile?
Yeah, sure.
And Sterling!
Oh, come on. Bjorn Kuipers, of course, will be the referee for the final, who's got history with Marco Verratti, of course, because in a Champions League tie, Verratti said that he swore at him.
Yeah, so they both must have spoken good English.
You know, and would you swear at a player?
Have I swore at a player?
Yes.
I would say yes, of course I have.
Right.
In the heat of the battle, I've swore.
Okay.
Has a player swore at me? Yes, in the heat of the battle.
Right.
Have I sent a player off for foul language? No, I haven't. So therefore, some things are said on the pitch in the heat of the battle, and it should stay on the pitch. Mm-hmm.
So why is Verratti crying about it? Why was he moaning about it?
Because they lost the match.
Right.
Simple. Mm-hmm. If you lose the match, you're going to cry. This is just football. Did he have a problem at the time? No. Did he go to the referee and say, you're out of order on the pitch?
Right.
No. If they'd won the match, do you think anything would have been said? No. But it always seems to be sour grapes. When a team loses, they look for excuses.
You swear at referees, Ali, they swear at you back?
Yes and yes.
Spanish or English? What was your preferred
both.
Method?
Yes and yes. Very creative. But creative, but can I say creative but respectful at the same time?
No.
No. I think there are certain boundaries that you don't go past. And when you swear at a referee, I know this sounds crazy and I know this sounds sort of counterproductive, but you don't talk about the referee's mother, for
okay,
example.
Okay, right.
The Spanish players did.
Respect.
In English. In English. I can't use the word, but it was the only Spanish I knew.
Finally, I've got to get your opinion on the Premier League. You've been faffing a lot with VAR. Like in its first season, of course, drawing a lot of criticism, particularly with the offside. There will be thicker lines now, and so it won't be right down to the millimetre. Does that make life easier for the officials?
Of course it is. But the game's changed so much. What upset me about VAR is that in the past, FIFA were adamant for goals. They wanted to see more goals. They wanted to see more attacking phases. Mm. And what VAR did, it destroyed this because two reasons. One, the offside was so tight. The defenders always had the advantage. And also handball was differently interpreted. If you handled it as a defender, it was no penalty. But you handled it as an attacker and it was a disallowed goal. So therefore, they've tweaked the handball law to allow the attacker to score, unless he directly scores himself. And now they've tweaked the offside, because what was happening was you can't have an armpit offside. It doesn't feel fair. If I'm pointing in the direction of the ball,
right,
and my sleeve is deemed offside, it doesn't seem correct. So what they're going to try and do is not use the precision which a lot of countries use, this 3D technology. When you use the 3D technology, we're talking millimetres. Are we talking how great football is, and we're talking margins of a millimetre? And what UEFA have done in this tournament, which is very similar to Holland, they've just drawn a line across and allowed your eyes to take that judgment. And I think everybody accepts that
right.
philosophy, and it's moved on within 30 seconds, and there's been no debate about offside.
Mm.
And for me, this is the best way, because what I miss about football is the emotion. When a player scores a goal, we can't have 30, 40 seconds of drama to draw the lines when it spoils the moment. So I think it'll be a great addition.
Can I say, to that point, the Dutch and the Eredivisie pioneered the use of video technology. They're the ones who presented data and their findings to IFAB when making decisions around VAR and the use of technology in the game. And they got it well straight off. They had their decisions down to 8 seconds of right. lag time. Yet, as you build on it and it was introduced to the wider game, you see a greater use of technology, and all of a sudden now you're debating over decisions for three and four minutes
yeah.
as opposed to 8 seconds. And it just felt, as much as we applaud the use of technology and the need for the right decision, it just felt like it was taking away from the game somewhat. So to hear you say that the way the Dutch do it, that was how it was introduced and that is how it was sold. I'm not sure how we got to the point that we are now.
Mark Clattenburg, thank you for a month I've been with you. It's the most sense you've spoken in that time. What's next? ESPN FC tattoo across the heart?
Yeah. Or Division West.
I'm sorry, what?
Love that hope. Excuse us?
This is Thomas, might be watching. Be careful. Just a reminder, you can always check out our content over on our YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe to ESPN FC. A couple of last bits of business. Lukas Podolski, what a reception he had. This is in Poland. Where is this in Poland?
Zabrze.
How do you know that?
Because that was the first time that I was called with the national team. France play against Poland in Zabrze.
There we go.
Which is at the border of Poland and Germany.
Wow, there you are.
Yeah.
Thousands of
geography and everything on this show.
Well, you know, Lukas, a little bit of culture doesn't hurt.
Meanwhile, for Inter Milan's first training session after the season's break.
You know where Milan is.
All about Christian Eriksen. Fantastic scene. Here as the staff and the crowd alike saluting the attacking midfielder.
That's great.
That's it then. That brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much for everyone who's been on. Thank you for watching. We'll, of course, be back tomorrow. No extra time today, but we'll be here reflecting on the European Championship final, of course, tomorrow, which is live on ESPN England, taking on Italy. That game at 3 p.m. And then join us at 6 p.m. here on Plus as we'll be breaking down that big game at Wembley.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate is to not search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/FC. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.